Turn to the 29th chapter of Ezekiel. We are studying today God's judgment against Egypt. Let me go back and review briefly what we've had thus far on these nations in Ezekiel. And of course, you remember how that it comes down something like this. Here's our Galilee up here, and down here's the Dead Sea, and here's Jerusalem here. He began with Ammon. Ammon was out over here in this part of the country. He came on down here to Moab. Now, Moab was this country right in here, between these two rivers here. Here was Moab. Then he moved on down to Edom. Edom was this country here to the south. He moved on up from Edom there, something like this, with Edom here. Moved on up here to Philistia. Here are the Philistines here, coming down something like this. Then up here to Tyre. There was Tyre here. Here was Sidon. Right from Tyre to Sidon. So you can see he was kind of making a circle there. And now he moves from there down to Egypt. Now Egypt way down here, of course. Down here is Egypt. The prophecy today is concerning Egypt, which makes seven nations that he dealt with. Now in the lesson today, or rather dealing with Egypt, there are seven distinct prophecies concerning Egypt. I don't know whether that was intentional on the part of the writer or whether it just turned out that way. I don't know. We have about seven of these concerning Egypt. Now he begins, now remember that Egypt had been one of the great world powers for a long time. I guess it's one of them among the oldest, going back to 3000 B.C. or maybe to 4000, or maybe somewhere along there, 2500 to 3500 B.C. It's been a very strong political power in the world, dominated the world for a long time. But now then God is prophesying of its fall and destruction. It's going to be brought to an end. Now in dealing with it, Ezekiel uses an allegory, not like he did with Tyre. Now, remember in Tyre, he likened Tyre unto a great ship, because it was a commercial people there. You notice where they were? They were here, a little narrow body of land. Here were the mountains back here. Well, they couldn't farm that, and here was the sea here. So naturally, they turned to the sea and became the great commercial power of their day. Now, Egypt had been a great military power, and the Nile, which was about 4,000 miles long, but Egypt only extended up something like maybe 1,000 or 2,000 miles, most there ever was, but it was a narrow piece of land, narrow there, bordering the Nile River. A great farming country. The Nile would overflow at a certain time of the year. That would enrich the soil. Then they would go in and plant, and then the river would go down. It would rise and go down. So you would almost set your calendar by the regularity of it. And so you now use the allegory of Egypt of a crocodile. I believe the King James Version used the word dragon. But dragon is a wrong word. The dragon is simply a mythological thing. A creature never existed. Breathed fire and all that. No such thing as a dragon. But this monster was a crocodile. So in his allegory of Egypt now, he likens Egypt unto a crocodile that filled the river Nile and the canals round about it, and all the little fishes that stuck to its scales, and when it came out, represented the people. So we'll look at this allegory that he uses here in this. In the 10th year, in the 12th day of the month, the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, now this would be about 7 months before the fall of Jerusalem. Now Jerusalem fell in 86 really. It started in 86. This is about 7 months before the fall of Jerusalem. Son of man, set thy face against Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and prophesy against him and against all Egypt. Now Pharaoh stood for or symbolized the whole nation. The king was the symbol of that. That was true of most of those countries. The king symbolized the nation or the kingdom itself. That's true here. Now speak and say, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, behold, I am against thee, a Pharaoh, king of Egypt, the great monster, that is by the crocodile. The old version, I think, says dragon, but that's not right. It's the crocodile that was the symbol of them that lieth in the midst of his rivers and has said, my river is mine own, and I have made it for myself. And that's an expression of pride, arrogance. And those pharaohs, they thought of themselves as being deity, as being God. They deified themselves, and they were deified by the people. So God condemns them for thinking himself as God, for he's just a man like everybody else. and I will put hooks in his thy jaws, and I will cause the fish of thy rivers to stick under thy scales, and I will bring thee up out of the midst of thy rivers, and will and all, with all the fish of thy rivers will stick under thy scales, and I will cast thee forth into the wilderness. Now that word wilderness is better desert, for the Nile River, the area from anywhere from 4 or 5 to maybe sometimes 12 miles on either side, might be further, but beyond that was desert, the great Sahara Desert there. And so take a crocodile, he couldn't last long out of water, put him out of the water then, why, put him out there in the desert, it wouldn't be long before you're rotting. Well, that's what God said I'm going to do to you. I'm going to draw you, the crocodile, and the fishes that stick to your scales, which I don't know if fish ever stuck to the scales but of an alligator, but nevertheless, it's a figure anyway, it's just an allegory, a figure that. I'm going to drag you out here and leave you to be the pit food for buzzards and animals there. So I'm going to bring you, catch in the wilderness, thee and all the fish of our rivers, thou shalt fall upon the open field. Thou shalt not be brought together, nor gathered. I've given thee for food to the beasts of the earth and to the birds of the heavens. And all the inhabitants of Egypt shall know that I am Jehovah, because they have been a staff of reed to the house of Israel. Now there are two reasons why God's going to bring them down. One was the way they had treated Israel, not only when they were in there as captives, but then now in this day of the threat of the Babylonians, before that the Assyrians. Why, Egypt had promised a great deal to the people of Israel, but never fulfilled any of it. They always fell down on it. They looked only to themselves. They were concerned only with their own material prosperity and wealth. You couldn't depend upon them. Now, they had one time been a great power. Now, they were waning at this time. But the people of the world still looked upon Egypt as a great threat, a great military power. But actually, they were in a state of decline at this time. God said, I'm going to bring them to an end. But at any rate, this is the figure that you have. Now, when they took hold of thee, that is Israel did, by thy hand, that is break and is rend all their shoulders, and when they leaned upon thee, thou breakest and made all their loins to be at a stand, that is helpless. All right, now let me look at what Rabshakeh said back in 2 Kings, and Isaiah quotes it, 2 Kings 18:21. I want to turn to that. 2 Kings 18:21. Then I want to look at it also in Isaiah. Isaiah quote says the same thing. I don't know which one originally. I imagine Isaiah was. Anyway, 18:20. Now this is the Rabshakeh. That's simply a military title of the Assyrians. Now here's what he said. Said unto them, Thus ye now to Hezekiah, thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein thou trustest? Thou sayest, but thou art but vain words. Now that's Rabshakeh's accusation against Egypt at that time. They say that they're vain words here. Thou sayest, there is counsel and strength of the war. Now on whom dost thou trust, that thou hast rebelled against me, that against Assyria? Now behold, thou trustest upon Egypt, whereon if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, unto all that trust him. In other words, it's like a reed or a staff. You lean upon it and it breaks, and then it goes into your shoulder here or pierces it. Now, Isaiah said that same thing in Isaiah 36 and verse 6. Let's look at that just to see whether you can decide which one said it. I imagine Isaiah the one that said it. Whoever wrote the Kings simply quoted it. All right, now here's Rabshakeh, and the word that he sends in verse 4 says he's a great king here. Now, verse 6, behold, I trusted upon the staff of this bruised reed, even upon Egypt, whereon if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all that trust on him. But if thou say unto me, and so we trust in God, who is this God, so on. So this Rabshakeh, who's the author of this idea, that when you trust in Egypt, you're leaning upon a reed that when it breaks and you wait there, it'll pierce your shoulder and make you helpless. And that was the point there. Right? So that's what he says about it here. And you'll be a staff or a reed here to the house of Israel. So Ezekiel is quoting here what Rabshakeh had said, as recorded by Isaiah in 2 Kings. All right. So now that's not. So what's your picture? The picture here then is, here is Egypt. Here's a great crocodile. Here the fishes are clinging to it. That's the people there. And it's brought out and laid out, put out here in the desert, on the sand in the wilderness of the desert. And it rots and becomes food for the animals and food for the birds. Well, that's what God says all Egypt is going to be. That's what I'm going to do to Egypt. And the Jews have leaned upon him. And they did. Every time you had a weak king in Israel or Judah, he go running down there and try to make an alliance with Egypt. Egypt never did help them. They always fell down on their promise and on that covenant that they would make. So God says, now there are two things. Well, I'm going to look at the other one now. Now he comes to from the leave the allegory to a literal thing. Therefore thus saith the Lord Jehovah, behold, I will bring a sword upon thee, and will cut off from thee man and beast. And the land of Egypt shall be a desolation and a waste, and they shall know that I am Jehovah, because he has said, the river is mine, and I have made it. Two reasons now. His attitude toward Egypt, toward Israel, his covenants he had made had broken, I had kept one of them, how he treated them, and now when they needed help, he'd fallen down. He would take the presents that they were sending, all right. All of the, what they would give Egypt to, as kind of a bribe, not a bribe, but pay a salary to help them, but he'd take that but wouldn't do anything. That was first, and second is your pride. I noticed. Because he has said that the river is mine, and I have made it. Therefore, behold, I am against thee and against thy rivers, and I will make the land of Egypt an utter waste and desolation from the Tower of Sevena, even unto the border of Ethiopia. Now that's to the south. That's up. Now remember, when the Nile River flowed north. So when you're talking about up the Nile, you're talking about south. We're accustomed to saying down south and up north, aren't we? So we get confused sometimes when we study the Bible, when it talks about up the river, but going south. And so at any rate, it's from the first cataract here, maybe on up to the sixth at one time. Even under the border of Ethiopia. Now Ethiopia was south of Egypt. No foot of man shall pass through it, nor foot of beast shall pass through it, neither shall it be inhabited 40 years. Now, there is no historical record of Egypt ever suffering this 40 years. I think that what he means here, let's look at the next expression. And I will make the land of Egypt a desolation in the midst of the countries that are desolate, and the cities among the cities that are laid waste shall be a desolation 40 years. And I will scatter the Egyptians among the nations, and will disperse them through the countries. I really think your 40 years is symbolic of a time designated by God. Now they had been 40 years, the children of Israel had been 40 years in the wilderness. 40 years is a it and seven are two of the numbers that are used most often in the Bible to indicate periods of time. Now, there is no account of any 40 years. So I think what he is saying here, now here is a period of time determined by God. Paul says in Acts 17, chapter 25 to 27, that he made of one every nation of men dwell on the face of the earth, having determined their appointed seasons and the bounds of their habitation. That is, Paul says that God determines the appointed season of a nation. How long it's going to last, when it'll be brought to an end, or for the extent of its border and boundary. So when Ezekiel says 40 years twice here, I think he's indicating a time determined by God. Because there is no 40-year period, but there might have been one that history knows nothing about. I don't know. But at any rate, since Ezekiel is such a highly symbolical book, so many symbols and all of that in it, I think this likewise would be a symbol. So like I'll send a sword against him, that is, I'll send armies to destroy him. The sword is a symbol of the armies that would come. Now notice what he's going to do to it. In verse 12 here, I'll make the land of Egypt a desolation. Now it had been the granary of the world back there at that time, and furnished the food for a great deal of the Mediterranean world, in the midst of the countries that are desolate, and a cities among the cities that are laid waste shall be a desolation 40 years. As again, you see three times, isn't it? Twice three. And I will scatter the Egyptians among the nations, and will disperse them through the countries. Now, two things there. I'm going to make them a desolation. I'll send the sword upon them. I'll make them a desolation. I'll scatter them among the nations. So God's going to carry them away captive in this. For thus saith the Lord Jehovah, at the end of 40 years, that I gather the Egyptians from the peoples whither they were scattered. And I will bring back the captivity of Egypt and will cause them to return into the land of Paphos, that's one of the cities, the sections of Egypt, into the land of their birth. And they shall be there a base nation. Right? In other words, that's a low nation. Right? Now, there are three things: desolation, scattered, and a base kingdom. God's going to make them a base kingdom. Now, notice further. It shall be the basest of the kingdoms, neither shall it any more lift itself up above the nations. And I will diminish them. All right, a base kingdom, scattering, diminish them, that they shall no more rule over the nations. That's what they've done for so long. So their dominion here, they will be diminished here, and never return to their former glory. And it shall be no more the confidence of the house of Israel, bring iniquity to remembrance, when they turn to look after them, and they shall know that I am the Lord your Lord. No more will they turn to Egypt to trust in Egypt, after God has brought them below here. So the four things I want you to notice is, I'll make them a desolation, verse 12. And the latter part of verse 12, I'll scatter them. Now then down in verse 14, I'll scatter them. There'll be a base kingdom. And verse 15, I will diminish them, and there'll be no more rule over the nation. So they're going to be brought down, and that's true. Now you're going to mention Nebuchadnezzar here in just a moment. Now Nebuchadnezzar invaded Egypt and carried away some of the booty there, some of the plunder out of it. But really, it was left to Cambyses, about 525, I believe, somewhere along there. Cambyses, the son of Cyrus. He was the one that came down and really conquered them. But then, later on, Alexander the Great came in. And he overruled them. And at the death of Alexander the Great, the Ptolemies. There were 15 different Ptolemies that ruled over Egypt. During that time, the Ptolemies over Egypt and the Seleucids over Syria. And that put little Judah right between those two powers, and was kind of a buffer state between them and the battleground on which they fought a lot of their battles. That is, the Seleucids of Syria, not Assyria, but Syria, and the Ptolemies of Egypt. Now, this is dealt with in between the covenants. Most of this takes place between the covenants. So we have to look to. And Daniel foretold much of this. Daniel foretold much of this in that last chapter 2 of his book, but you have to rely on secular history to identify, because it's not dealt with between the covenants there. All right? Now, you do have the Maccabees between the covenants and those individuals. Very interesting. All right? Now that's concerning. Now, here is a prophecy that was just before the fall. Now, here's one that's come 17 years later. And it came to pass in the 27th year. In the first month, the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, now here's another prophecy, a different one you see. Son of man, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, caused his army to serve a great service against Tyre. That's back, we had that when he besieged Tyre there. We didn't take the city, he never did take it. Every head was made bald, and every shoulder was worn, that is. And the head from wearing the helmet there, and the shoulder from carrying stones and timbers, up to try to build a causeway, of course, which he didn't succeed in doing, to the island, and in building the siege works against Tyre, the soldiers wore themselves out, but didn't get any reward for it. Now, soldiers generally in those days were paid by the plunder that they got when they conquered another people. They took the plunder of it as a salary. Right? Now, Nebuchadnezzar had not taken Tyre, so therefore his soldiers were not rewarded or paid, though they serve God's purpose against Tyre. Now, you don't learn anything else from this, these kingdoms class. I want you to learn that God is in control. That God is the one that determines the appointed seasons of a nation and the boundary of it. He raises one nation against another there. You see that all the way through the Old Testament. And it's also in the New Testament, just two kingdoms in the New though to deal with. And that's Jerusalem. And Jesus said, you'll see him coming on the clouds of judgment there. That would be with the Romans. And then in Revelation, where it talks about the destruction of the Roman Empire, both were by the judgment of God. There are only two you could deal with in the New Testament. Well, you're on a covenant period there, you see, of less than 100 years, the whole thing there, out of the New Testament period. But now then, in the Old Testament, you've got all the way from Genesis clear on down, whenever you have the beginning, down to the end of the Old Covenant, with nation after nation to demonstrate God's rule over and control of these nations. That's why I think that this study is so important. Is that now then, you read your newspaper, you watch your newscast, from a different point of view from what you were if you didn't know this. You can say, God is at work. Just like Ezekiel looked into the storm and saw Jehovah, just like he looked into the destruction of Tyre and saw God at work, man saw a great nation fall. Ezekiel saw God at work carrying out his plan and purpose. And I think we can see that if we have the proper perspective of things and proper concept of the Bible. Right now, yet had he no wages, nor his army from Tyre, for the service that he had served against it. Therefore, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, behold, I will give the land of Egypt unto Nebuchadnezzar, king of them. Only Jeremiah and Ezekiel use that term Nebuchadnezzar. And I don't know why. I never have been able to find out why. That Nebuchadnezzar, same man, king of Babylon, and he shall carry off a multitude and take her spoil, take her prey, and it shall be the wages for his army. I have given him the land of Egypt as a recompense for which he served, because they wrought for me, saith the Lord Jehovah. Don't have that underscored. For they wrought for me. Who then was Nebuchadnezzar working for when he besieged Tyre? Working for Jehovah. God was using him. Right now then, who is he working for when God gives him Egypt? He's working for Jehovah, and God's going to pay him wages by giving him that. All right? So, in all of this, we see these nations working for Jehovah, serving Jehovah. I don't know what you believe about the nation today. Some folks, some out there don't believe that. I believe that God doing the same thing today did back yonder. Over and over, and I've preached this here several times, and you know my view on it. Maybe you hold the same view, doesn't matter. But, you know, of Jesus, he said that he rules the nation with a rod of iron, and he treads the winepress of the wrath of God the Almighty. Right? Is he bringing these nations in? So the Bible clearly teaches that Jesus, as the King of kings and Lord of lords, the ruler of the kings of the earth, is doing today what God was doing back yonder. So if God used the United States there to hear his same thrashing, it wasn't enough. Maybe God wanted to go on to quit. I don't know how about that. Maybe God still has some use for the same. Probably does. Probably use him a little more. Just like he used Tyre some more and used Nebuchadnezzar again. All right? So at any rate, I think God was doing that, and I think our time is coming one of these days. Talking to a friend of mine in Arkansas yesterday, she called me. A lady I've known for many, many years. She was my first wife's closest friend in school, and then after we married. At any rate, we were talking about this matter here of these things and the condition of today and what it looks like is going to happen. And she asked me the question, well, how do you think this judgment will come? I said, I don't know. And my guess is it's going to be economic. Give us an economic collapse in this country with a generation that's never learned how to work or get along without everything in the world they want. That's going to throw us into anarchy in this country. With an economic collapse and anarchy, then it'll be every man for himself. We'll be back to the claw and the draw, that kind of, in that time of that. Every man will be defending himself and looking after himself. And that could happen. That's what we have to guess. See, that's just a possibility. It could be any other way. God's got lots of things. He's got lots of arrows in his quiver. That's taught in the Bible. He's got lots of ways to do a thing. But at any rate, I think this helps us to see life as it really is. But he goes on to say, for they work they wrought for me, said Jehovah. And that day when I called a horn to bud. Now, a horn was a symbol of power. To bud forth in the house of Israel. Now, I don't know if that's messianic or not. It may not be. I doubt it. And I will give thee the opening of the mouth in the midst of them, and they shall know that I am Jehovah. In other words, God would restore Israel now back to their land, and a bud there, a horn would bud. So it would just be kind of a budding power. It would not be a complete power. But they did. And when they got back there, then after a while he raised the Maccabees, and the Maccabees defeated the Syrians. Then one of them wanted to be made a king, which was contrary to God's will, and that failed. And so they had lots of trouble there. But there was a budding power there. But they followed the Greek philosophy and Greek teaching to the extent that they were not faithful to Jehovah. For God never, the horn never did more than bud. And it failed. Well, I think this is what we have in that. Is there any question over that? Well, we come to another. I want to finish one more if I can. The word of Jehovah came again unto me, saying, Son of man, prophesy and say, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, wail ye, alas for the day is near, even the day of Jehovah is near. Now remember, that day of Jehovah is always a day of judgment. It's a day of release for some, It's a day of destruction for others. Now, some folk identify the Lord's Day and the Day of the Lord's Day. No, they're not the same at all. The Day of the Lord is an Old Testament expression over and over, always points to a judgment. The Lord's Day in Revelation 1 and verse 10 refers there to the first day of the week. That's the Lord's Day. Doesn't say so there, but everybody understood it. In all the early writings, they referred to the Lord's Day as the Lord's Day as the first day of the week. We're going to move on. The day of the Lord is near. It shall be a day of clouds, a time of the nation. Now notice, the clouds symbolize judgment. It'll be the day of the Lord will be a day of clouds of his judgment upon this nation. And a sword shall come upon Egypt. This is the day of the Lord for Egypt. And shall come, and anger shall be in Ethiopia, and as for the south, up the river. When the slain shall fall in Egypt, and they shall take away her multitude, and her foundation shall be broken down. So the foundation on which she is rested, her idolatry and all of that, will be removed. Ethiopia and Put and Lud, and all the mingled people in Cub, and the children of the land that is in league shall fall with them by the sword. Now notice that. Now these are those subject people, or her colonies, those under her rule. Now notice, when Egypt falls, then all of these will fall also, and the children of the land that is in league shall fall with them by the sword. So when Egypt falls, those that have trusted in her, that were allied to her allies, they're going to fall with them. They're going to come down together, God says. And that's what so often happens today. Thus saith Jehovah, they also that uphold Egypt shall fall. Those individuals were the stabilizing force, they're going to fall with it. So here's a complete fall of Egypt and all of her allies. That's coming. And the pride of her power shall come down from the tower of Sedina, shall they fall in it by the sword, saith the Lord Jehovah. And they shall be desolate in the midst of the countries that are desolate, and a city shall be in the midst of the cities that are wasted, and they shall know that I am Jehovah, when I have set a fire in Egypt, and all the helpers are destroyed. And that day shall messengers go forth from me in ships and the carriers of Ethiopians afraid, and make the carriers, let me read that, in ships to make the carriers Ethiopians afraid, and there shall be anguish upon them as in the day of Egypt, for the Lord cometh. All right, so not only Egypt, but Ethiopia to the south there, up the river, the Nile, it also would fall. Well, notice now next, not only is Egypt going to fall, all of our allies are going to fall. Ethiopia, which has been a part of Egypt at times and separate at times, is going to fall. Now come the idols. Thus saith the Lord, I will also destroy the idols. I will cause the images to cease from Memphis, and there shall be no more a prince from the land of Egypt, and I will put a fear in the land of Egypt. Now, that's another interesting statement. No more a prince. Right? Now, after the fall of Egypt, let me go back now to Cambyses, when Nebuchadnezzar didn't completely destroy it. Cambyses was the one that did the most damage to it. Now, he was a Persian. Right? So then you have the Persian rule. Then you have the Ptolemies. They were Greek. Then you've had the Mohammedan rule. You had British rule. You had French rule. In fact, from the time that it was destroyed, they've never had. And right now, the Muslims, Arabic people are ruling there. They've not had, and you couldn't identify an Egyptian anymore anyway, because they're so mingled up now. And the language has changed. They speak the Muslim language. Now, the old Egyptian language is lost. So never again would there be a prince of the Egyptian ruling over the country. So God brought it in. Now, it's true that these modern Arabs and those have tried to restore the glory of old Egypt, but they haven't done it, and probably never will. But if they should, that is not what was destroyed. That which is destroyed is destroyed. All of this is different now. It's the same thing with Greece. If Greece would become a great power, it's not that which was back down to old Sparta and Athens, the Athenians. It's not that. It's a different people. The same thing with Italy. Talk about Italy and Rome, the old Roman Empire being restored in Rome. It would be something entirely new. It wouldn't be the same thing. That's destroyed. Same thing with the Jews. Jews talk about going back and restoring the Jewish kingdom. Well, they can't do it without a king of the tribe of David, of the family of David. They can't do it without a priesthood of the Levites. And not a Jew on earth can tell you of what tribe or family he came from. so it would be. Whatever they've got over there is not a restoration of that which was destroyed. Can't be until you have a restoration of the Davidic lineage on the throne and a restoration of the old Jewish system of worship. Moving on. So when you talk about one of these millennia, talk about these things, Rome coming back and being restored, all that, and the Jews being restored, why are they talking nonsense? I can understand smart people, and I guess they're not as smart as I have to give them credit for being smart people, making such fool statements. Can you? I can't figure that out. But let me go ahead. God says, no more shall a prince of Egypt, and I will put a fear in the land of Egypt. All right? And I will make Pathros, that's now your name's about eight of the seven villages. You know you to go over there. Excuse me. And I know you to name all of those. Coming on down here now to about verse 18. It comes on down there. Ptolemies will withdraw itself, and I shall break there the yokes of Egypt, and the pride of her power shall cease in her. As for her, a cloud shall cover her, and her daughters shall go into captivity. Now, the daughters of Egypt, like the daughters of other nations, would be the provinces. Now, those allied people, those that she ruled over. Thus will I execute judgments upon Egypt, and they shall know that I am Jehovah. All right, now comes Pharaoh's defeat and fall, and the main point in verses 20 through 26 is that God is in it all. Now, no, they'll never have another prince, and they haven't, and they never will, where nobody can prove he's an Egyptian anymore. They're Muslims now, more Arabs, so a mixture of people. All right? And so now then, the point is, in all of this, God is ruling. Now, and it came to pass in the 11th year, in the first month, in the 7th day of the month, that the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, I have broken the arm of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And lo, it had not been bound up to apply healing medicines, to put a bandage to bind it, that it be strong to hold the sword. Right? Now, again, you see a figure of speech there. He broke and breaking Egypt. Why, he broke the arm? He broke the arm of the sword. He broke a power. Egypt's power would be broken by Jehovah. Notice God said, I did it. I want you to underscore that word, I have broken, son of man, I have broken, verse 21, the arm of Egypt. It shall not be healed anymore. Therefore thus saith the Lord Jehovah, Behold, I am against Pharaoh, another I, am against Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and will break his arms, his strong arm, and that which was broken, and I will cause the sword to fall out of his hand. In other words, here's a man that's fighting, but you break this arm, you got no arm to hold a sword. God will break both arms of Pharaoh. He'll have no power to retaliate or to fight back or restore his greatness which the former had. And I will scatter the Egyptians among the nations and will disperse them through the countries. And I will strengthen the arms of the king of Babylon and put my sword in his hand. Now, God said, when I break the arms of Pharaoh, he'll be helpless. I'll put my sword, whose sword? My sword. For it's God's sword in the hand of this individual. Now, what does Paul say in Romans, the 13th chapter, which I preach on that in a Sunday or two? I'll preach on that for Romans. There, when he speaks there of the civil power as being a minister of God, and he beareth not the sword in vain. God said, He's my minister. So the civil power is a minister of God bearing God's sword in the accomplishing of what God wants to accomplish. You know, that's awful hard for people to believe and accept. The reason for it is, the reason in the Bible that God is love and God is merciful, and He is, He's all of that. On the other hand, God is a consuming fire. God talks about His wrath, His sword. So what God does is use one political power as His sword to destroy another. And the civil power itself, the ruler of that is, bear not the sword in vain when it comes to exercising capital punishment. So the government of the people is God's instrument to execute the judgment against the wicked. This country completely ruled God out. So I know we're going to have a judgment. I know it's going to be a terrible judgment. Because we ruled God completely out of the thing, and man has elevated himself just like old Pharaoh did. That we're gods. We determine our destiny. We're the ones that do this and that. And so here the criminal that, according to God's law, ought to be put to death. I kept in an air-conditioned cell there, maybe for a year, and then turned loose and chopping up whatever happened, cost thousands of dollars to take care of them. When God says, put the man to death. Well, what do we do about it? Nothing. We let him go. We reject what God has said. So what we need to learn is that God is God. He rules in the kingdom of men. He uses civil government, civil power, to carry out one aspect of his purpose, whereas he uses the kingdom of God, the spiritual, to carry out another. I've illustrated many times as a tree. Here's a tree growing up. Here's a fruit up here. The fruit on the tree. Here are the roots down here. Now, what is civil government? Civil government lops off the fruit of this tree. What's the Christian response? He works on the root of it, the root of crime here. Here, a tree of crime, that's what I'm talking about. Here's the tree of crime here. Here are the roots down here. Here are the fruit of crime. Civil government lops off the fruits of the crime, of crime. The Christian works on the roots of it, removing crime by destroying the root of it, which is in the heart of the individual. But we're failing. We're not getting our job done. Civil power is not doing its job. So what's going to happen? I think both of us will come under a judgment. When the judgment falls upon the nation, we'll suffer along with it because we haven't done our job as fully as we should have done it. You think about those things. Think about that. It's something to really consider. I don't think this lady, you called me yesterday, said, have you heard about the church at Highland? They say they're even using women now to wait on the table and other things and giving them prominent places in the church. That's different Highland. It's a good church there. Well, I was not surprised, but I was shocked, rather, but not surprised. I asked my son last night, I said, have you heard that? No, he said, I'm not surprised because they're doing everything else over there. So here's the idea. The church now is not doing what God put it here to do. It's ignoring God in so many ways. The nation ignored God. So when the judgment falls on the nation, we're responsible for not working on the roots as we should have. So we're going to fail in that judgment also. Think about that. All right, God goes on here. But I will break the arms of Pharaoh, and he shall groan before him with the groans of a deadly wounded man. That is before the king of Babylon. And I will hold up the arms of the king of Babylon, and the arms of Pharaoh shall fall down, and they shall know that I am Jehovah, when I shall put my sword into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he shall stretch it out upon the land of Egypt. And I will scatter the Egyptians among the nations, and disperse them through the countries, and they shall know that I am Jehovah. What's the point of verses 20 through 26? It is that God is in it all. God is in charge. God is in control. I don't know how that makes you feel, but sure that encourages me. I look around and see the way that the thing's going, the way we're winding up here. If I put my trust in God, Jesus said, believe in God, believe also in me. So if I believe in God, believe in Christ, that is my source of my power. I'm not worried about what the consequence is going to be. I know it'll be a righteous judgment. I know that we're entitled to it. We've been asking for it in this country 50, 60 years now. And I think God's going to give it to us. Not a very good thought, is it? Most of our preachers today, they don't preach like that. That's not the way we preach. Make people feel good. Make them feel good. That's what's wrong now. They've been feeling good so long, you think they're on some kind of a spiritual drunk of some kind. But that feeling good is not so good when the Lord comes with his sword in his hand to execute the judgment. Well, we'll take a couple of chapters more than that, and we'll finish that up on Egypt next time. Well, the classics.